Welcome back to episode 313. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Well, this week we had a interesting development. We had this dust up between Elon Musk, of course, the owner of Twitter X, and the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. I think this stemmed from a well, one thing, you had this hashtag ban the ADL trending on Twitter. I think it was started by one Keith Woods. I think he's an Irish nationalist. After, I think he was at an American Renaissance conference, and this he tweeted after he found out about the meeting between, of course, the ADL CEO Jonathan Greenblatt with the Twitter X CEO Linda Yaccarino, regarding, I guess, the meeting's subject or issue was the expanding censorship in the name of fighting hate speech. I think she had sent out a message or a tweet. I had a very frank, productive conversation, Linda X, yesterday about X and what works and what doesn't. I guess he tweeted that, and where it needs to go to address effectively to address hate effectively on the platform. Greenblatt is, of course, is a as I mentioned, ADL CEO, a sort of Israel lobbyist who, for some reason or another, ADL doesn't have to register itself as a foreign agent under FARA, but I guess they get a pass on that. Of course, Greenblatt is a leading advocate of internet censorship under the guise, of course, of combating hate speech. He said, "I appreciated her reaching out, and I'm hopeful the service will improve. ADL will be vigilant and give her and Elon Musk credit if the service gets better, and reserve the right to call them out until it does." So it's kind of a threat. I think people understand what that is. Is, of course, ADL can extort and threaten companies because they can organize boycotts, either overt boycotts or behind the scenes, and pressure these companies, go after other companies that they rely on, like I think like Google platform, or go after financial services or other companies that may advertise on Twitter X. I think Elon Musk said the revenue had been down. Was it? I'm sorry. Was it like 60% or something since the ADL?
Strange, large number. Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
really large. It started even before Elon Musk had even taken over the company. So they were out front doing this. They kind of jumped the gun on it and created this controversy. Musk, of course, has criticized Yale in the past, and the meeting happened to come only days after the Attorney General Merrick Garland. Coincidence. His Justice Department is going after Elon Musk's SpaceX for hiring U.S. citizens over refugees and asylum seekers. And this is a strange. I think this is Kristen Clark, the black supremacist who runs the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. She's a devotee of Leonard Jeffries, the late Professor Leonard Jeffries, who believed in black supremacy or
right.
superiority because of melanin or something, some theory.
Yep. Right. Yeah.
But she's headed up the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, and
Yep.
apparently they're saying that they're discriminated against illegal aliens, even though there's a law that prevents Elon Musk from hiring illegal aliens. So it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. There's also reports of a DOJ and the SEC probing Tesla. The Wall Street Journal reported on Wednesday that the federal prosecutors and U.S. Attorney's Office of the Southern District of New York, I think that's the one, that's the gal who's going after Donald Trump on his tax filings or something, and questioning how his wealth was assessed for loans. But anyway, this is the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission, are seeking information about how much Tesla has spent to plan and build a secretive project. There's also some question about the federal government is now investigating Tesla and the claims made regarding its battery range on its cars. So it seems like this is the typical intimidation that happens when someone, I think, runs afoul of the powers that be. And of course, this is exactly the type of pressure you'd expect, something that the ADL would coordinate with Merrick Garland, who's also Jewish, in doing this. So we have this going on. And then we had this, this ban the ADL, meaning suggesting that ADL should be kicked off the Twitter platform because it's working actively to destroy Twitter business. So why do they still have a platform there?
Well, and Musk said he was going to sue the ADL or threaten to do so.
Yes, there's a lawsuit, not just for defamation. I think there's also a lawsuit regarding what's called tortious interference, when you interfere in contracts.
Right.
And it's an extortion racket. People know what the game, people in the know or who are informed us know how they do it. You know, they will blackmail, and they will pressure other companies to cancel contracts, literally, and force companies to, like, pay penalties like they did with Kanye West last year. And because it's much better than that, than, you know, be sanctioned by the Jews that control finance in the country.
Well, and it was very useful because the subject then became something people could write and talk about. For example, Zero Hedge had articles on the history of the ADL, mm-hmm. and on the overall, you know, political thrust of the organization. And they were pretty damning. They, you know, basically were asserting that they were thugs and terrorists, you know, and were that used leverage, political leverage, financial leverage to silence people. You know, I mean, that was actually asserted in articles that appeared on Zero Hedge. So that was very interesting to see some, you know, perspective on the ADL, because with the mainstream media, you know, it cannot really criticize the ADL because they're all part of the same.
Yeah, how is it this outfit gets to determine what's considered acceptable public discourse? And
yeah.
It is called this concept of hate speech, which is an ADL term, I believe.
Now, who defines it? And yeah. And how can, I mean, how does, in terms of the legality of it, how do you defend yourself against possessing hate? You
know, yes.
It's just it's a ludicrous sort of legal principle, and it's not falsifiable. And so, you know, with the right jury and, you know, judge, anyone can be convicted of it. So it's a way of the whole hate speech and hate now as a meme in the media is just a way of circumventing both reason and the legal system. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just what it is.
Yeah, how is it that, of course, it's significant because the ADL partner is a trusted partner with the FBI and the Department of Justice, despite its sordid history that we'll get into. And yeah. So they have a lot of power. And of course, there's also informal power that they enjoy because there's a Jewish organization. Some groups are claiming that, like Steve Miller, the Trump guy who's Jewish, claimed the ADL is a leftist group. It's not a Jewish group, which is kind of absurd because it literally was created by B'nai B'rith. Yeah. And it's not leftist. Yeah, there are things that it support that we would associate with the left, you know, like open borders, right, mass migration. But they certainly don't support that when it comes to Israel. So it's not like this is a matter of principle for them. They support open borders and abortion on demand and degeneracy and transgenderism, and gay rights, and all that other nonsense, a breakdown of national identity, because that to them that is the interest of Jews. You know, the cosmopolitans, and it's not a leftist.
Exactly. And they, you know, and they never have any introspection whatsoever. I mean, these charges are made exclusively against Europeans and the condition of the Palestinians and, you know, the way that they're treated, that is not even open for any kind of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in a position where they're able to define, know, whoever they want is evil and make sure that no one ever accuses them, the Jews that are involved with the ADL, of anything that's malevolent. And really, this is, you know, I mentioned before we started recording that the history of the ADL, the context from which it emerged, I think is useful for people to know because it gives an understanding as to, you know, what the organization is, and it actually more or less can be traced to Manzini. Of course, it's Manzini's a part of a continuum as well, but, you know, Manzini was the terrorist and organizer, and of course, he's an enormous Freemason, and when I go through this little, you know, description of the history of what led up to the ADL, I'm going to point out this combination, this odd combination of Judeo-Masonic connections. And the first one is basically Manzini, who is purportedly not Jewish, though there are people who believe his family was converso, which I think is likely. But in any case, he certainly was a fellow traveler of Moses Hess, right? Moses Hess and Manzini basically worked out both theological and political concepts, which then became both, you know, kind of Marxism for one.
This is the middle 19th century?
Middle 19th century, yeah.
Like, so this is the rise.
Early 1835.
So this is the dawn of like nationalism.
Well, the nationalism is coming about primarily from the efforts of this group.
Mm-hmm.
Manzini started the whole process with a political society that he called Young Italy. It's a secret society. It's designed to promote Italian unification, and it's basically completely Freemasonic. I mean, these are the facts that are available for anyone. He was really the first one to publicly use the concept of the workers' paradise to, excuse just radical power being, you know, concentrated in the hands of a few people. Others have tried this in the past, but I think most of them were just benevolent idealists. But Manzini is clearly malevolent, and he was going after Christianity, which is, as a Freemason, you know, natural, since Freemasonry's object of destruction is Christianity. And he taught that the era of Christianity was over. And he actually wanted to replace Christianity with racial nationalities. And of course, this would lead to control over them. I mean, a very small group that I think that the Masons felt they could control. But anyway, he taught, and this is sort of, I think, kind of this is something people should bear in mind when you look at the process by which the ADL comes about, is he said that liberty is not the negation of authority, but only every authority that fails to represent the collective aim of the nation. So who defines the collective aim? Well, you know, friends of Manzini. But so, in other words, he isn't really, you know, liberal in the sense of like sharing power. It's just a kind of sophistry where the idea of sharing power is given to the public to promote revolution, which Manzini and the organizations that he created do around the clock. They are just constantly trying to subvert and overthrow longstanding, you know, monarchies and republics too. I mean, it doesn't matter. They want to just have radical change throughout all of Europe. There's only one monarchy that Manzini supports because it has very deep roots among the people. You may have guessed this, it's Queen Victoria. So this is, you know, you can see the kind of the connection between Manzini and the Masonic British power structure. I mean, Victoria was the only one that Manzini supported, and this is obviously, kind of showing his hands as to who he is and what he's representing. He was quite a perverted individual. I'm not sure you recall this, but, you know, he actually took over Rome. He worked with other Grand Master Freemasons. There were three or four of them. And eventually, in 1849, they were able to, for a short period, they took over Rome. And during that time, Manzini staged an actual mock Eucharist event in the Vatican that he called Novum Pascha. So, it was a theatrical production which featured him and then God, who was actually giving some dialogue, and the people. So, you know, you can see that this is, you know, kind of street theater of Freemasonic perversion at a very clear level, right? So he said that he told the people that he really wanted to create his own Italian national church. That would have been a lot of fun. And he was going to set it up on the Anglican model. Now, one really important thing about Manzini is that he, you know, because they're chasing him constantly throughout Europe, but he ends up in London, where he's actually taken in and supported by Lord Ashley, Earl of Shaftesbury. Now, this is just a critical connection. People must understand how important this is, because Shaftesbury is the individual who actually coined the expression that Palestine is a country without a people and then should be given to a people without a country. Shaftesbury, with Palmerston, who was his father-in-law, they were the proto-Zionists. So, you know, you have Zionism that's kind of given to us in, you know, newspapers and history and things, which is it's a Jewish sort of bubble up kind of thing that occurs late in the 19th century and then reaches its zenith with the Holocaust, and, you know, somehow they take over this area. But in fact, it was a Freemasonic project that started in like 1840. And the two individuals that actually made the first public declarations about, now we're going to move the Jews back to Israel, were Shaftesbury and Palmerston. And as I pointed out, absolute news to the Jews. Abba Ibn, who was probably the premier Jewish intellectual in Europe, he said, we have no idea what Palmerston is talking about. This is, where is he getting these ideas from? Why in the world is this occurring? He should, you know, they were saying, well, actually, you know, the Jews want to be in the House of Commons. They don't want to be in the wilderness in Palestine. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this was the, this is the world that Manzini is in. And then, you know, you've got just all sorts of young Europe and young Argentina. There's young Armenia, young Russia. These are all Freemasonic organizations. They say that there are other things, but if you get into them, you can see they're all being promoted by Freemasonry. And their primary purpose is just to disrupt the political structure, with the idea of eventually having revolution take hold. And in fact, it happens over and over again. Young Russia was really directly leading to, you know, the chaos following World War I, in which Lenin could come in and take over the country. So the chaos that these groups created was very powerful politically. And I'll just mention, because this is an important connection, is that one of the really important individuals in this was in the Young Turk, you know, which was designed to overthrow kind of the Ottoman Empire, set up the condition in which you know, Palestine would be brought under the control of the British, who could then give it, you know, to the Rothschild family and the Jews. And the Young Turks had, you know, as one of their leaders, in fact, he was in charge of their newspapers and whatnot, was Vladimir Jabotinsky. Now, I don't know if you know who this piece of work is, but he is the Zionist leader who actually set up the Irgun and talked about the necessity for violence, and actually, as well documented, he put bombs in vegetables and eggs that were brought to the market, you know, as part of a terrorist campaign against Palestinians to drive them out. Now, this is very important. You can see that here you have the Zionist Young Turk organization, which is trying to create chaos in the Ottoman Empire, and it's being intellectually headed up by someone who is in fact a Jewish Zionist and a terrorist, who then Jabotinsky actually then goes on and makes a very important statement, and he said that Manzini's ideas were the basis for the Zionist movement. So this is a you know, a statement that has kind of disappeared from history, but you know, obviously when you get to to Herzl and the second wave of Zionism, you've already had this long trajectory of the young young Turks, young Armenians, et cetera, all of them, you know, leading to chaos, and all of them for the purpose of basically ultimately creating a Freemason control over these countries. In America, we had, you know, the Young America, which is actually becomes young Israel. So you have an individual who's a Freemason and really very important in sort of the history of the ADL, though you can't find it in Wikipedia. And his name is Edwin de Leon. Do you know who that is, Tim? Edwin de Leon. He was a Jew from South Carolina who was very important in Scottish Rite Freemasonry. And he was also the premier slave trader in the South. He was literally the guy of the slave trade. Edwin de Leon, very powerful individual. And he was the leader of the Confederate Secret Service. So he was a huge slave advocate. So he gave a speech and said that we need to set up a kind of a young Israel, just like all these other organizations. And this is really what becomes B'nai B'rith. B'nai B'rith is set up by the same individuals who have come from Young Israel, which had been set up by Edward de Leon. They knew and worked with Isaac Wise, and he then, of course, and just to digress, then he Wise is the person he was promoting slavery, the Ku Klux Klan, and was deeply involved in Freemasonry. Again, you have the Judaic Masonic connection. And he worked with Judah Benjamin, who was head of the Confederate Secret Police, basically, or the intelligence agency, who was also a Scottish Rite Grandmaster Freemason, Judah Benjamin, and worked with Albert Pike. Okay, so there you have the Judeo-Masonic connection. Pike is, supposedly from some other ethnicity. I don't know what he claims, but he doesn't claim to be Jewish. But actually, there's a bust of Pike. I'm not sure it's still standing. It's in New Orleans, and it celebrates the work that he did for the Scottish Rite, of course, for the KKK, and for the B'nai B'rith. So he was basically, standing in both camps. Judah Benjamin, his uncle, was the one who'd actually created the Northern Scottish Rite organization, which Weiss belonged to. So it's just this clump of individuals that are all Masonic and are all, have these close connections with Jews. And so now, I had mentioned a couple of weeks ago that you have the end of the Civil War, and Weiss had two B'nai B'rith workers, Simon Wolf and Benjamin Piazzo. And they were both getting money from August Belmont. So now you have the Rothschild connection into this. So they were Belmont being the Rothschild financier. So he was supporting them. And part of what is being supported was their famous Hebrew amateur acting school, which included supposedly the non-Jewish John Wilkes Booth. Now, this is,
wasn't that Tony Blair's wife?
Yes, is related to John Wilkes Booth, right? So, and John Wilkes Booth is recorded in a newspaper as being virtually a spitting image of Simon Wolf. They just couldn't get over how similar the two looked. They were like father and son, is what they were described. But anyway, so Wolf goes to Washington. He's representing B'nai B'rith, and he works with Albert Pike and Judah Benjamin, right, the Confederate Secret Service guy. They were arrested, but somehow B'nai B'rith was able to get them released. And then when you have the end of the war, you have the Lincoln assassination.
Mm-hmm.
Now here you have just B'nai B'rith is all over this, and I have opinions and some understanding of this, but it's too long a digression. I'm sorry to be so long-winded anyway, but Wilkes was using money from and had his banking through the bank that was used by Wise and Judah Benjamin. The fact is that they found in John Wilkes Booth's trunk a coding device. Okay, so this was a little decoding thing, encoding thing, which you could send secret messages with. And they also found the same device in the office of Judah Benjamin, who was the head of the Confederate
mm-hmm.
Secret Service. So the two of them had this capacity to exchange secret messages with one another. Just before he went to Booth's theater, Booth met with, of all people, the B'nai B'rith Washington chief, Simon Wolfe, who then gave an explanation that, that Booth was upset about losing a girlfriend, and that's why they killed Lincoln. So fairly ludicrous. Now, Wise then is one of the founders of the ADL. The ADL, of course, really comes out of the a Frank affair, where you have the lynching of a Jewish individual who had been convicted of murdering and raping a 13-year-old girl, and so they then created a media campaign. Even though at the time it was absolutely clear Frank was guilty, but
this was the out of mostly in the north and particularly New York.
Well, this is kind of an interesting thing. Again, I'm going to write an article about
in
this.
Chicago. I think Albert Lasker.
Too much of the of what, because I think we'll just lose people if we go into too far. But the one fact that's fascinating is that Frank was actually indicted by a grand jury.
Yes.
And five of the jurors were Jewish,
mm-hmm.
from very prominent Jewish families. None of them ever voiced any kind of regret over their decision, because the facts on the ground were just straightforward. Frank had been the last person to see her. This black person that they had were trying to hoist as the guilty person, was the victim of planted evidence. And then, the thing that I think is probably, what is really important in terms of the ADL is that you end up with, what they did was they spent money. So they raised what would be equivalent of $25 million in present day mm-hmm. dollars. Okay. And primarily this was done on perjury and to create falsification, which is admitted in the letters of the individual who kind of overran the whole thing.
Yeah, that was Albert Lasker.
Right. Now, Lasker was the premier kind of public relations media personality. Imagine at this time, 1913, there wasn't, there was some propaganda that had been, scientifically organized. But this guy was like the biggest, basically, publicist in America. He worked for major brands and did advertising campaigns.
Yeah, but it's interesting. As early as 1913, Jews could coalesce and wage a behind the scenes boycott to pressure
right. newspapers. Well, what's just amazing is that this individual Lasker actually has letters which are in public domain, in which he just basically says that Frank is guilty and we had to put on a. He doesn't use those expressions, but he says he's a pervert. I wasn't happy. I wasn't unhappy when he was lynched. He uses that kind of language.
Yeah, but he admits to spending money to obtain perjured testimony.
He admits to this. Justice. He actually says that this is what we needed to do. And everyone was, he was like having discussions with Albert Ochs, you know, one of the publishers of the New York Times. And so, and so anyway, you know, so now I'm sorry to have been long-winded, and that's probably too much information. I know most people won't probably absorb much of that.
Well, they claim that Frank was convicted because of rampant anti-Semitism in the South, which simply didn't exist in 1913. In fact, if anything, the South was philo-Semitic, at least much more than the North.
Yes, yeah, exactly right. And that's why you had five Jews. The Jews were highly valued in this, in Atlanta, in this society. They were very well integrated and were, there was.
They're literally claiming that these Southerners, these bigoted Southerners, were willing to railroad a white Jew and ignore they claim that a black
had, so they could protect a black man, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So
this doesn't fit the narrative, does it?
Right? It's just ludicrous. And Leo Frank was, in my opinion, just there's just no question. But now today you have
remember Frank was convicted, sentenced to death, and his sentence was miraculously commuted by the governor Slayton of Georgia. Now, did some of that $25 million end up in the pocket of Governor Slayton?
I mean, I don't have the citation, but I'm willing to bet my life that this is exactly how it was done. So there's just so much money sloshing around, it's beyond belief. I mean, you have to imagine what today's $25 million would do in 1913 Atlanta. I mean, it just became like Pfizer. I mean, it was everywhere. You know, there was just no getting around the thing.
It's a lot of money, because I think Mary Fagan, when she went to go, when she died, she was going to pick up her paycheck for, I think, for the week. And it was, I think it was for $1.95 or something.
Exactly. And that is a really good way to look at what, you know, $25 million in today's money would have done back then. It was just, so all of this Jewish money was able to, coming through the ADL, who was...
Well, really, so wasn't Frank also head of the B'nai B'rith down there?
And this is why the ADL was basically founded. It was because Frank was the head of the southern region of B'nai B'rith. And that was actually my punchline.
Oh, sorry.
And that's okay. It's actually, but it's kind of self-evident. So this is, you can see that, you know, when you look at how the ADL comes into public domain with its, attempt to whitewash Frank's guilt. And then you look at Frank being the B'nai B'rith's head, president of the B'nai B'rith of this region. Well, suddenly looking backwards to B'nai B'rith coming through the murderous and propaganda-drenched, organizations that Manzini had set up. Albert Pike is part of this, you know, Judah Benjamin. I mean, this is just one, sort of malevolent character after another. And now Frank rapes and murders a 13-year-old girl. He's the head of B'nai B'rith. And it's B'nai B'rith that's actually being defended. I'm absolutely convinced they could care less about Frank. It was they wanted to whitewash it because they really didn't want any of Frank's connections and what that meant back into B'nai B'rith.
Yeah, I think at the time there was a journalist named Tom Watson down there, and he was sort of this populist journalist. I think he parlayed this event into a political career, became a state senator, I think.
Yeah.
But he said, he asked the question because he saw what was happening in the media, and he was reporting the local news. I think he started a newspaper to combat the Jewish propaganda offensive that was being waged by all the major newspapers outside Atlanta. And he simply asked the question, are we going to have two laws, one for the Jew and one for the Gentile? He asked that question. Obviously, B'nai B'rith thinks there should be a dual law.
Of course. And now, Tim, can we ask the question today?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there you have it. And that's why the context of organized generational Judeo-Masonic evil that spawns B'nai B'rith and ADL.
Well, what's interesting about the whole Leo Frank case is not so much the behavior of one Leo Frank. You know, obviously he's a degenerate and a psychopath, a sociopath, and he's a murderer. It's the behavior of organized Jewry. They're coalescing, circling the wagons around him, that tells you the nature of organized Jewry, even as early as 1913 in the country, how they saw it as a threat to them. Even though he was guilty of sin, he was convicted, I think, either of five or six appeals all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they still were pressing. Then they purchased his clemency, probably with the intention that he'd eventually be released. Of course, that was prevented by the mob that dragged him out of prison and lynched him.
Yeah, an eyewitness came to light 67 years later.
Yeah.
So yeah. The whole thing is just, but
here, by the way,
the point with Leo Frank, you know, if you look at this in the context, that's important in my opinion. Just as you say, it's not Leo Frank who is a degenerate and a murderer. And incidentally, part of the testimony against him were other women in his factory who all testified the same thing, that he was a sexual degenerate, a pervert, a predator, and he was especially lustful after this 13-year-old girl.
Yeah. See a picture of her. She's a very pretty little girl, yes.
Right. This was just the testimony that had been obtained of all of these female workers, you know, at the factory. So just as you say, the point here that has to be understood is not Leo Frank. It's the response by this organization of Jews, the ADL, the B'nai B'rith, that cares more about sort of just the possibility of some kind of analytic process that may go back and trying to figure out, well, what is this B'nai B'rith, you know, that he's a part of? What is this moral structure?
And the willingness of Abbot Lasker et al. to write about false stories, how the mob was, hang the Jew, false narrative about anti-Semitism rampant in Atlanta and throughout
exactly.
the South.
They're just making all this stuff up.
Distorting reality. But yeah, gee, haven't we seen that before?
At the expense of any kind of real sense of concern over the dead girl. This is just, you know, and also, in fact, there's Nation of Islam had put out a book on this. Mm-hmm. They did it because they didn't like the slander against this black guy. They thought this was unacceptable, and they said, look, this is just a typical example of how blacks are railroaded by powerful Jewish media interests into, we have to take on the guilt, even though this, you know, it's a clear example where we weren't.
Well, to this day, the ADL and organized Jews claim that Leo Frank was innocent. He was lynched. And that's an example of anti-Semitism. Then are you saying the black guy did it?
Yeah,
They don't say that. They just leave it open. And they talk about how, you know, you read the transcripts of the court, how Leo Frank's attorney, you know, was all types of things. Like, the nigger Connolly. Actually, that's in the court proceeding.
Oh, they just absolutely, yeah. I mean, they couldn't be more racist. The support here is coming from families like the Schiff families involved.
Jacob
Remember,
Schiff, that's right.
The family shows up. They show up a few years later marching with Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
But here, you know, the little girl was killed by a filthy, you know, I mean, and the Nation of Islam actually, you know, has great documentation on this, of how, you know, these powerful Jewish families denigrated this, the race of this individual as part of their ways of deflecting people away from the leader of the B'nai B'rith organization in the South, you know. So yeah.
I think right now there's a play on Broadway, the Leo Frank case.
Go on.
Of course, he's innocent in the play. There was a movie, I think, on HBO in the 90s. I remember that's the first hint I got of the case was I was channel surfing and I came across this movie. And for the longest time, I thought, oh, just know, you know, story of, you know, the benighted South and anti-Semitism. I didn't think much of it. Saw it in the mid-90s. Starred Jack Lemmon and Peter Gallagher. You know, a good-looking, gory as Leo Frank.
Good God.
He's being railroaded, and the heroic governor steps in at the expense of his political career. That's how that's portrayed. Then years later, I'm reading about the case in E. Michael Jones's The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. I go, wait, you know, that's the first I heard, you know, I even understood that he got details of the case. And now, ironically, because the ADL keeps pressing it, people ask, well, who's Leo Frank? Oh, then they look into it and they go, oh, that's interesting. better off just shutting up about it.
I tell you, it's really, Leo Frank is really important. I mean, it's just a single act, and you know, it's how much significance can it have in terms of history? But man, it's a very clear prism to understand how Jewish control of the media, how it creates propaganda, and how they are absolutely relentless. Once they take the position, doesn't matter what the evidence is, it's just mind control. The Wikipedia article literally simply states the fact that Leo Frank is innocent, right? Was innocent. Yeah. Even though his wife, after meeting with him, refused to ever again be in a room with him. So I guess she didn't get the memo. So, you know, but now there's actually kind of a revisionism, or, you know, that's occurring. Ron Unz wrote an article about the episode, and he said he was amazed when he started getting into it, because he has the same position that everyone does, that Leo Frank was lynched. It was a mob. He was innocent. Unz actually went out there and just said, no, it appears to me that he was absolutely guilty.
Yeah. Well, he was lynched in quotes because organized Jewry had subverted the criminal justice system and the legal process.
Yeah.
So when the justice system is perverted, you have to get justice elsewhere.
Right. And so this is, you know, Jabotinsky and blowing up Arabs, you know, who, by putting bombs in milk and egg crates, Leo Frank. This is the trajectory, the heritage, the ethos of the ADL.
Well, this is the organization that is now policing thought on the internet and the media, directing, you know, what's the content of commercials and media. And this is the moral, outlook of an organization that's controlling what we're allowed to think and say in public.
Yep. And that's why we really need to have more of scrutiny on the Leo Frank, not so much the murder, but on the propaganda that the Jewish organizations created following the event, so that people can understand that what we're experiencing today, control over the internet, is literally a continuation of this.
Well, hate speech was created because with the internet, they had lost control of the narrative because of the democratizing effect of the internet and the ability to reach a lot of people with these views. And they had the control. They had to impose these restrictions again, and they're doing it behind the same tactic as Albert Lasker is behind the scenes, threatening, extorting these companies, getting them to behave.
You know? Exactly right. And that's why this needs to come, you know, has more sunlight on it, because you have to put Lasker's PR campaign into the context of our present situation, because it's exactly the same. It's they're using the nudge technology on the internet to simply wipe any scrutiny over their behavior, so that people who get their information through the internet are literally controlled. And that's, of course, the purpose of creating the thing. And now this is coming, you know.
Well, the ADL is the one that pretty much wrote up the national strategy to combat anti-Semitism at the White House at a conference last spring in May.
Yeah, that'll be really objective.
And the ADA meets with the FBI, harass that person, arrest that person. Oh, look at them. Say this at a press conference. You know, say it, talk about white supremacy being the number one threat and ignore a crime, black crime. You know, that's the ADL's pressure. And FBI agents cannot get a badge before they graduate. They have to go to the Holocaust Museum. I think they have to pay the $17 ticket too before they're given a badge. You have to go on a tour of the Holocaust Museum.
Yeah, do they pass out my article, "The Freemason Invention of the Nazi Party," to just round out the understanding of the event? I mean, yeah. So, you know, I mean, it's just clear as a bell. And the person who I think is at least honest in this really miserable, sordid affair is Lasker. Because if you read his quotes, I mean, he was just very straightforward. You know, yeah, we're bribing people, we're changing testimonies, we're influencing politicians. Frank is a pervert. I'm glad they lynched him. I mean, but it's all of that is irrelevant.
Well, so what for civic nationalism and American citizenship? What matters to him is he's Jewish.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, it's like, wait a second. What about justice? What about America? No, we're Jewish.
No, that doesn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this isn't a characterization of like the Jewish people, but it sure is a characterization of the Jewish authority group.
Well, because of narrative control, I would say a majority of Jewish people support the ADL.
Of course they do. There is victimized, and I hate to say it, but a large fraction of European Americans do.
Well, they think it's a anti-hate group.
Yeah, that's right. They don't know any
like
better.
Like the Southern Poverty Law Center. You know, they're fighting poverty. How can you be against a group that fights defamation?
Yeah.
They're anti-defamation. So that's, you know, come on. Yeah. How can you be against that?
Right. Or how can you, you know, be opposed to someone who is trying to stop hate speech?
Yes. And you support hate? You want to hurt people's feelings? But that's the problem. An organization like the ADL, a very small group, number of people that represents another small group, which is, Jewish Americans, is they're able to exert so much control. And in a liberal democracy, we're supposed to, at least in theory, the idea that the people rule, they vote and all that. But really, the reality is it's the people are manipulated by the media. So narrative control is very important. And that's what really controls public opinion. That's what Walter Lippmann wrote about. You know, that's what, you know, Edward Bernays wrote about. These things, that public opinion doesn't really exist. It's created, it's formed. And so when you take into consideration that, our government works with these outfits like the ADL, to control the flow of information to the American people about so many things. And you have, whether it's YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, you know, they've all been exposed, at least it's been real, that they have worked with the FBI, who liaises with the ADL and very closely with the ADL. And it's a question of who controls whom here, really. Well, obviously, I think the ADL at this point controls the FBI. I mean, after all, again, if you go against their agenda, you're purged. Even the president of the United States, Donald Trump, lost his Twitter account, you know. But the president, you know, the federal government works with these organizations, I mean, namely ADL, to censor, deplatform people. The media cheers it because they don't like to compete with the internet. And so they'll use excuses of fighting terrorism or white supremacy or misinformation or medical misinformation, what have you. To protect our democracy. But, it's not as if, again, the ADL, I guess you could say it's left liberal, but it's really a Jewish organization. It's a creation by Ayn Rand. It actually is an agent for the state of Israel. It actually, on its website, says it defends the state of Israel, which means it's a foreign agent. Why doesn't it have to register as a foreign agent then under the FAR Act? It's because it's Jewish privilege. They don't have to do this. I mean, as recently as the 1990s, the FBI was investigating the ADL for its domestic spy operations, engaging in corporate espionage, break-ins, bribing, I think it was the San Francisco police, getting files on people. That was settled, brushed under the carpet.
Yeah, but Tim, I mean, Jonathan Greenblatt bragged that ADL, through its partnership with Google, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, that they could get them to change the algorithms to meet their demands.
Yeah. Right? That's why if you look up certain names, the first thing that comes up on Google is what the ADL has to say about them.
Right. No. And so this is what we're looking at when you use Google, YouTube, Facebook. They bragged about that's exactly the kind of power that they have. And then of course, remember, we've seen now through the whole vaccine and COVID stuff, that the government organizations are influencing and involved with all of the social medias.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's just a matter of fact and documented that the White House, the FBI, DHS, and UK government, they're all involved with this clump of control over the internet, every single one of them. So, you know, the ADL really needs to be understood in the kind of context I feel that we're talking about today.
Well, I mean, it's not going to happen because they're working with the Justice Department, but a RICO case should be brought up against them. You know, this is a racketeering operation.
Exactly right.
A classic racketeering operation. I don't like RICO law. I think there's a lot of problems with it. But if you have it, it definitely should be applied to them and, you know, not to Operation Rescue or pro-life activist.
No, but actually RICO could be used here. And mm-hmm. it'd be great if some brave DA would try to see if you could get that into court. With just the idea of, you know it's going to, when it gets to higher level courts, it'll be kicked out. But for heaven's sakes, the disclosure you could get would just be.
Well, I don't know. It goes for a judge, Judge Jewish. What's going to happen? You'll have a judge who thinks like Abbott Lasker. He won't look at the law. He'll think, well, before I'm a judge, I'm a Jew. That's how people like Abbott Lasker and think this way. We know this, how they think this way, because it was organized Jewry that lobbied so hard to get Jonathan Pollard pardoned. Yeah, why? Because he's Jewish. Yeah. Even though he betrayed America, damn it, he's Jewish. He needs to be pardoned. You know, all that, you know, so that's how they think. And I don't know, because, you know, B'nai B'rith is a secret society. So we don't know if judges belong to it or not, do we?
Well, again, you know, you have the, I try to, you know, and so some of the presentation I do to show this Judeo-Masonic connection occurs over and over and over again. And so to explain it, I feel, you know, you need the concept of the lifetime actor, you know, that, you know, Albert Pike may claim to have Christian tradition, but actually that's just a persona.
Well, here's the thing. Here's what I saw Jonathan about say this. Someone said that, are you asking donations from companies right now as we speak? Or are you pressuring them to withdraw support for Twitter? And he goes, that's an anti-Semitic trope. So, yeah, but is it true? But this term anti-Semitism, of course, it's purposefully difficult to define. They can obfuscate the definition because they've created a situation where even asking what it means gets you in trouble. What are you, only anti-Semite ask what anti-Semitism means, because everyone knows what it means. No, they don't know what it means. The term, you know, it became so powerful and so damaging to people that anyone smeared with it, you know, would simply ignore the issue. They fear they might be smeared with it. So as soon as the ADL or other Jewish groups are preparing to smear someone, people just give up. They don't want to fight because it isn't worth it. I mean, look at like Kanye West. It's like Joe Sobrant's quip, anti-Semitism. An anti-Semite used to be someone who didn't like Jews. Now it's someone the Jews don't like, you know. And there is no definition. I think it's the, what's that? Or IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. They actually came up with a Remembrance Alliance, came up with a working definition of anti-Semitism, and it had something to do with perception. It's defined behaviors that constitute an expression of anti-Semitism, but it does not attempt to actually give us a definition of what it is. Now, of course, what anti-Semitism really is, it's criticism of Jews, criticism of the ADL, criticism of their power, acknowledgement of their power, and holding them account. So they simply think they should be exempt from criticism. So basically, if you're not a philo-Semite, you're an anti-Semite. That's not a very good situation for our society to be in, for our country. And no, if anything, the resentment people are feeling is because the people now know the ADL and other major Jewish organizations, they believe in censorship. They want to suppress free speech. That irritates a lot of people. They fundamentally know it's unfair, and they get very suspicious, and they look at all the corruption. You know, so they brought it on themselves, as they do so many throughout history. Then they turn around and blame people for feeling of resentment over it. But it's a perfectly natural response to someone who's misbehaving, or you know, your group of people who are misbehaving. But that's the history of the. Of the Jewish people.
Well, it you know, as when you analyze it in this context, it comes down to basically the description of a race war. You know, I mean, that's
Yeah, if
kind
you
of what.
see it in terms of ethnic warfare, then you understand. And whataboutism or calling out the hypocrisy doesn't mean anything, because if you're at war, then yeah, they're going to do if they can get away with it.
Course.
So, no.
And I think that, you know, going through the history of the ADL, the secret societies that spawned it, and the level of just constant terrorism that these organizations engaged in, you had better, you know, be aware that this is the context that we're operating in now. You'd better be aware that it's going on now. The destruction of the Ottoman Empire that was, you know, begun with this weird group, the Judeo-Masonic group, the Young Turks, is in fact spinning around in all of Western society, iterations of it, you know, descendants of it. And so it's a hard place to make a good life because they've reached such a degree of power. You know, where they've got particularly the federal level, they just seem to have that locked down. And so let's hope that in fact there is a lawsuit from Musk that would try to bring some of this information
Yeah,
out.
I mean, he's claiming a loss of $22 billion. That would put a dent in the ACLU budget.
Yeah, you know, and I mean the money, I mean, I'm not sure Musk needs it, but I would just think the public needs the disclosure.
That's what people need to know. Yeah, it's the public disclosure about these things, and also the idea that, you know, obviously with the information we're getting, the media coverage we're getting is all seen, distributed through the filter of the ADL. Why do they enjoy that privilege? Who are they to determine
Well,
what's
they're the
acceptable
ones
and
with
discord?
control of the who are they? They're the ones with control over the political, legal, and media.
Well, then people should know that and then
Right.
and act accordingly.
And exactly right. And this is just, you know, we come to this point quite often in our discussions, but it just is the matter of fact.
Well, that
And
power
so
problem is extortion only works if people give in. Once you say no, the bluff, and that's it.
exactly.
This is a bluff. Right now, they exist because they're piggybacking, or they're exploiting a liberal system, meaning they're invoking property rights, First Amendment, freedom of speech, civil rights to protect
And
their
all of
interests.
that is
But they
the
don't
same.
respect that other, but they don't
All of that
perform
is the
those
same
rights to other
thing as
people.
all of that is the same thing as Albert Lasker's propaganda.
Yes.
All exactly the same thing. It's
But
just
what if a
there's no
group doesn't
difference.
play by the rules? Do they? We're getting back to a situation where we have to rethink things like Jewish emancipation. There was a reason that prior to the Napoleonic period, that there were exclusionary laws, restrictions, punitive laws that restricted them. That was an illiberal system, but liberalism is very much a myth, because liberalism only works if there's reciprocity. There's no reciprocity with these people. I mean, what I mean by that is the attitude of the organized Jewish community. The major Jewish organizations are all anti or censorship, anti-free speech, and they want total power.
Well, and also
That's their posture.
they produce absolute crap degenerate culture, which is why there is kind of a resegregation occurring right now, in which people are leaving inner cities which are controlled by Soros-funded DAs. And even though they may not be able to articulate it, what they're really looking for is kind of a European-centered culture, middle-class small town that they
It's true, but
can.
running, 10 more miles down the interstate isn't going to solve the problem, is it?
No,
I think
it
you're
should.
running out of space, and in the
Well,
meantime,
that's
exploring
right.
society. Yeah.
The suburbs didn't work the first time, and I guarantee you they won't work this time. So you have to do something about it. And
Well, the
you know.
suburbs were there to deracinate, destroy identity, to create the very white people who have no basis for their own identity anymore,
Yeah.
except for being evil and being blamed for everything. Then they
Right.
have an identity. Or if they want to exclude you from a Ivy League school, then they know what white is. Other than else, white
Suddenly,
doesn't
it
exist,
becomes
right?
clear.
It exists for the purpose of exclusion and blaming and guilting and having you pay for it,
You know,
everything.
it's a great point, Tim. It's like our modern vernacular doesn't work unless the Europeans have this automatic self-correcting system inside their mind where they can like reinterpret words so
And
that,
here's another thing: is it's not ADL. There's analogs to the ADL all throughout Europe, and they do the exact same thing in every European country.
of course.
You know, They're doing it in Hungary, in Romania. I mean, it's like in Ireland and in Germany, and you know, so we see a pattern here.
Well, look again. Go back in time. Look at all the like young Germany, young Armenia, all of these Freemason organizations, which are Judaic Masonic connections. They were there for chaos, right? That's what they were set up for, and also social control. Read the editorials that Jabotinsky was writing about the evil of the Ottoman Empire. You know, trying to kind of limit the ability of the people in that area to think clearly about the political situation that they're experiencing. Hey, this is the same thing we're dealing with today, and like you say, just moving further out into the suburbs. I mean, that of course is the only, you know. Now I want to back up a second. I couldn't agree more with your idea that this isn't going to solve anything in the long run. However, I would also point out that if you are in a Soros funded DA zone, got to get out. I mean, there's nothing you can do. I know people who are leaving right now. I mean, literally a couple families I know, they're just taken off because they've just too much violence.
Well, at some point, these people have to get the Bella Kuhn treatment.
Right. Well, exactly right. But what you have to do is the Europeans have to grow a spine. And they have to do that. They have to shake off the effects of the propaganda, you know, get clear minded so they can understand and have a grammar that they can, you know, when they have the self-correcting kind of process to their language where they can't even speak clearly about what their reality is. And they're not going to make it very far as rebels. You know what I mean? So they need to not just create courage, but create mental clarity, you know, so stop the beating around the bush and not being able to name the problem. You know, the problem is the Jewish oligarchs, you know,
here's a good example. It's how oligarchy. Elon Musk, you know, obviously they're trying to destroy his company. And when someone says, well, ban the ADL, hashtag ban the ADL, Jonathan Gubat immediately comes out. It's anti-Semitic. Why is it anti-Semitic?
Right.
Yeah. I thought you're in the business of anti-def. Oh, so you are a Jewish organization. No, we're not. Well, your website says you are, and that's what you created. Right. But nevertheless, you're claiming you're a civil rights organization, education organization, you know, whatever. But my point is that just by criticizing your organization, it's automatically anti-Semitic, which is, by your definition, any criticism. So you are Jewish.
Right. So why don't you put that into your title? You know, it's because it's, you know, so it's a promotion of Jewish self-interest and of Jewish propaganda.
Yeah.
You know, and
the point is, this you get around all the time. I'm tired of it. Well, not all Jews. That's not all anything. It's like not all Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. Not all Germans invaded Poland, but we say Germany invaded Poland. Germans
right.
invaded Poland.
Exactly.
The Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
We have to self-correct our normal, comprehensible
language. There are collective, I mean, the Japanese people, for better or worse, were represented by the Japanese government and their military. Same with the German people in 1939. The Jewish people, for better or worse, are represented by these major Jewish organizations. This is the Zionist state. The Jewish Zionism is everywhere where Jews are. That's their own ideology, which, by the way, makes every Jew a target of suspicion for their loyalty, because that's the doctrine of Zionism. If that's their primary loyalty, it undermines the idea of the liberal, civic order where you're a citizen.
If you're like a European person and you're engaged in either political or economic relations with Jewish people, wouldn't the most obvious perspective to take is that, you know, I better be careful here? Because
what's different is you're not dealing, when you're dealing with Joe Normie, who's maybe used to be an Episcopalian or Methodist or Catholic, you're dealing with him. When you're dealing with Jews, you're dealing with a people, and the Leo Frankake proves that.
Yeah,
as early as 1913, all the way up to now, or with Jonathan Pollard. Jonathan Pollard was an individual, but for some reason, he spied for Israel. Because he's Jewish, and he betrayed his country. Well, he didn't see America as his country. The Jewish people are his country, which is represented by Israel. That's why he's a hero. He was feted like a hero when he landed in Tel Aviv and was met by Benjamin Netanyahu on whose plane? right? The Jewish oligarch.
Yeah, it was Soros. Didn't Soros send him
Wasn't
out?
Soros? No, it was that the gambling guy? What's his name? He's dead now.
God.
GOPF. His name fails me now. But anyway, basically, it was a Jewish billionaire who flew him on his personal jet. Okay, so obviously, that Jewish billionaire saw him as a hero, not a traitor to his country. Right? I mean, so, I mean,
Yeah.
that illustrates that, you know. And there's an agenda here. There's, you know, that's. They support mass non-white immigration into Europe, you know, ethno white countries for a reason.
Everywhere,
They support abortion and feminism. They support
the
homosexuality and transgenderism.
Yeah,
they support quote, civil
DNA,
rights. You know,
Tim, the intellectual DNA is the same anywhere they go.
Yes, and they
and
support
that's
all
why,
these things.
you know, you're not going to have the Latvian Jews come out in opposition to hormone blockers for you know preteens. I mean, the intellectual DNA is literally a uniparty, right? It has one concept for everything. And so that's one of the ways you can demonstrate that you're actually dealing with racial interests when you deal with many of these individuals, because otherwise there'd be some diversity, right? There'd be some differences in opinion. But, and also well, it's so dangerous, Tim. I mean, just to digress, I mean, I don't know if you caught it, but Megyn Kelly, you know, the Fox News, like blonde talking head, you know, she now is coming out saying that she thinks she has a vaccine damage, right? She'd been one of the big promoters of the vaccine. And now, you know, that she's getting sick. And if you look at the all causes mortality and a lot of the other statistics, the vaccine is really, you know, diminished health and accelerated death and diminished birth. You know, I mean, it's obviously correlated. You know, these things are all happening after the fact. And there's the media, though, of course, will not, you know, bring this information to the public because, frankly, it's in the control of this single state race of, you know, opinion. And therefore, they don't see any problem. You know, it's like in the Ukrainian war. You know, the Ukrainians are being slaughtered, walking into automatic weapon fire. So what? We have to diminish Russian, you know, military capacity. The Gentiles, those bodies don't get counted, you know. And so is this, you can see how dangerous the world is for us, right? The medicine, you have to be very careful of. The political maneuvers, the military. I mean, these things are unfortunately in the hands of people that they could care less about, you know, whether or not you live or die. In fact, they would probably prefer you be off the planet.
Yeah, and again, it was Colonel McGregor says this is neocons from the Peril of the Settlement.
Right. Yeah, McGregor's one, you know, he has the self-correcting vocabulary, you know, where he doesn't really want to go out of the way and say, you know, Jewish interests. But he does, you know, he dog whistles quite a bit. And you listen to him at all?
Yes.
I listen to quite a bit of his podcasts and quite a few a minute, and he dog whistles a lot. He'll talk about powerful people in the, you know, military and political establishment that have problems or have had ancestral problems with people in Russia. Oh, well, gee, wait a second, Doug. Who could they be? Are you talking about the Cossacks? I mean, you know, like, who are you talking about there, Doug? So he dog whistles, but everyone knows, you know, we all know what he's talking about. I mean, I'm glad he can even use the euphemism in a public way. I think that's very, very valuable.
Well, people, when they say people, you know, have an ancestral resentment towards Russia, and now they're prosecuting this war to vindicate, you know, their hatred of Russia. Well, he's not talking about, you know, Germans or Poles, although
right,
Poles,
of course not.
Yeah,
yeah,
and that's the difference here is that this is a group that's the groupiest group that ever grouped. As someone once said, is their ethnocentrism is a key Jewish value, and they'll talk about that. But any other group, well, particularly Gentile,
well,
whites,
the other group is on the F scale.
Yeah.
This is authoritarian personality where all, you know, attributes of ethnic pride authority, power. These are all, for Europeans, are all neurotic.
Yeah, for white, it's racism. It's evil. It's, you know, and they've done the polling because years of programming to talk ethnic whites. They're, at least according to the polls, their ethnic identity or their ethnicity, only like 2% of whites consider it important. I think as
yeah, I wonder about those polls. I
they're afraid to say it.
But there are people who are afraid to say it, and also because the polls could be falsified.
Yeah.
But I will say it is, of course, dramatically smaller than it was in 1950.
They're embarrassed to admit it. They don't even know how to articulate it.
Yeah.
Hey, man, what are you saying, man? We're all individuals, and it doesn't matter. We're a melting pot and these things. And all that was fine and dandy when the country was 85-90% white, and that was the default position, and you can indulge these things. Then when they start, you know, flooding the country and changing the demographics, and the country starts to disintegrate, and the power grid fails, and the planes crash, and the bridges collapse.
it's funny. I was talking to this guy, and he was talking about that eventually he thought that America would need to get into the Ukraine to kick the Russian ass because we're the only country who can really do it, you know. And I said, gee, Lanny, I don't know, buddy. You've seen like the transgender takeover of the universities, right?
Yeah.
You know that those institutions are basically crap. You know, they're absurd. There's no education. They're just useless. And he goes, yeah, that's true. I go, well, you're just missing the fact that the same rot is inside the military. Believe me. There isn't some kind of, like the John Wayne battalion that's going to show up. You know, I mean, that's the military now in the United States is just a joke. They have a few, I guess, units, like the 101 supposedly is very, and they have the special forces, but you're talking about a few thousand people. You know, we don't have like a million man army or 500,000 fighting men. It's just the military is primarily just a wealth transfer system, for the.
Well, traditionally in America, the only group that's willing to be fodder for the empire have been, rural Midwestern or white Americans.
Yeah.
You know, that's the, yeah. That's, that's what people are now thinking. I'm not going to go fight for this empire. It hates me.
That's why it's kind of interesting. You know, like they have so many Ukrainians that have left, and now all the Ukrainians that stayed are dead. So they're having to go out and try to capture or find political ways to get the Ukrainians that have, immigrated to all these other countries to get them back in. Could you imagine being a Ukrainian, like in Canada? And that getting your orders, well, you got to return to the Ukraine to, get into the armed services. They won't get 1% of the population to return. These people all disappear into the mist. So the Ukrainian situation is interesting to digress. I think they'll raise another army. This one, the one for the counteroffensive, is pretty well shot. They'll try to gin up another army. I mean, they have... I don't know if you've been following this, but they're really going into a general mobilization where they're just taking anyone who can like fight. They have like one estimate I read was 60,000 individuals with one leg. Can you believe this? I don't know if this is correct, but and I was thinking, well, we have the 101 as our fighting force. I mean, the Ukrainians could have the 1-1.
Mm-hmm.
The one-legged division. I mean, and that's kind of a cruel characterization, but you get my point. This is just ludicrous. This is just ludicrous. This is the same situation my grandfather faced at the Somme, mm-hmm. where they were sitting there with guns at their back saying, if you don't go forward, we'll shoot you. He went out and got mustard gassed. But this is what's going on in the Ukraine. And just like with the Holodomor, which we've talked about 100 times, the media is only giving fairy tales to the public to make sure they don't have a political reaction, wherein we cut off the funds for this genocide, right? Because they're talking about the Ukraine is winning. Look, they're making progress in this. They're just being genocided. The Ukrainian, they'll come up with one more army, I would suspect. They'll need like, I don't know, 70,000. So they'll have another spring offensive. I think you'll have another round of this, and then they'll have to start working on the polls. They already have political agitators to gin up the Polish people to get ready to, you know, come in and volunteer to, you know, and they'll march every single European ethnicity into automatic weapon fire that they'll put up with it. The only way this thing is going to stop is if the public, you know, gain control from the politicians. This is what I tell people in Ukraine whenever I have a chance to have email exchanges with them. I go, look, you're in a life and death situation and the political class is basically murdering you. You have the right of self-defense. I have no suggestions as to what to do, but I know you're in a situation where you have the right of self-defense. You know, it's that simple.
Well, you mentioned the Holodomor, and that's anti-Semitic.
I know it is.
ADL, yeah. I was there a few years ago, I guess it was maybe 20 years ago, Abe Foxman was visiting Ukraine, and one of the government officials mentioned the Holodomor, and he told him to be careful, don't talk about those things. Don't compare it to the Holocaust, the, you know, capital.
Yeah, what he said was is that this isn't productive. Let's stop talking about that. And that's what he said, it's not productive.
Yeah, not for, we won't talk about it.
Yeah, complete mind control.
I think he said, be careful. I actually warned him.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Just absolute financial domination.
There he is, Mr. Abe Foxman, you know, baptized Catholic.
Right, yeah.
He's there, this little old organization, right? Lecturing an official of a supposedly sovereign government what he can talk about. Now, if we just, Jews are just individuals. Who is Abe Fox? Who has his backing? Why? How can he issue that threat?
Well, and also, Tim, this is the Holodomor.
Yes.
I mean, isn't this something that is sort of like the birthright of the Ukrainians to discuss? I mean, the gall of someone to tell a Ukrainian politician that that's not an appropriate.
Well, you can't talk about it. It's like Jews will lecture Ireland not have, they don't have a memorial to the Holocaust, to the Holocaust. They don't have a memorial there to them. Well, you know, Irish have their own suffering they're concentrated on.
Yeah, that's right.
They actually lecture the Irish. You were neutral during World War II. What did you do to stop the Holocaust? Like, what? it's Ireland, for Pete's sake. We weren't at war. Is it our responsibility? Yeah, my grandfather was living in a thatch roof hut at the time. What was he going to do to stop the Holocaust? Well, one thing is that, you know, that kind of like never really happened, at least as you say, that narrative. But I would love that how, you know, time passes. They start lecturing countries who weren't even involved in the conflict because they didn't do enough to save the Jews. Just like America, just like Ken Burns' series on American Holocaust, where
that was racism. Yeah.
It's Jewish gratitude is. You know, I'm watching a few years ago, they did the one in World War II, and I'm told that America was key to stopping the Holocaust and stopping Hitler from taking over the world. Now, years later, there's a documentary blaming America for the Holocaust. It's like, it never ends. It just gets worse. It gets worse.
You haven't been catching any of the kind of the news about Sergei Paskininsky. He's the guy who supplied all the weapons to the government people and for the Maidan, and it was responsible for a lot of the and he's making a fortune now. He's there. They call him as the Ukrainian arms supplier, right? He's a weapons dealer, and they've caught him involved in the Maidan, you know, the false flag.
Mm-hmm.
And he is quoted as saying that if anyone brings this up, when you get back to Israel, you'll be killed. This is what he said. He says, "You guys, so you better be careful. I don't even want this idea that you know I was involved in any of this." So, you know, you have a situation where it's hard to get the information out. There's lots of ways they can intimidate, but. What do you think? ADL, is it in decline? Is it being exposed more and more?
I think Jonathan Gutbett has done the organization and also the Jews to look for it for, you know, as a to prosecute or to promote their interests has done them a disservice. Yeah, because he's doing something they shouldn't do is calling attention to it. But they're much better off working from behind the scenes. I think maybe now at the pinnacle of their power, I think they can afford to be obvious, and we're seeing that. And that might be overplaying their hand.
Yeah, right on. But you know, the thing is, there is a growing awareness, and that's kind of what the hope and the goal is now. You know, just every day, just more and more people need to become aware of this.
Yeah, I think people who are somewhat informed now look at the ADL as obviously, at the very least, looking at it as a political, not as a sort of an apolitical organization dedicated to civil rights. They look at it, it's just as a venerable institution that you can go to look for like real statistics, like on crime. You know, I always find it funny when the FBI or somewhere cites the ADL on like anti-Semitic incidents or crime.
Right, I know. Like, wait a second. Some kind of authority. You know,
is there authority on this? Go to the ADL.
There was like 4,000 anti-Semitic hate events in the last 2 weeks, and we're up like 32% from last year. You know, it's like
send us more money, okay?
Right. Yeah. So it's just ridiculous. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. Inch by inch, brother. I think we're getting there.
The funniest thing is when like Tucker Carlson highlighted the ADL's position on the on protecting the Jewish state as an ethnic Jewish state and protecting its borders. At the same time, it advocates open borders for the United States to all the, ethnic white countries in the West. Like, that's a contradiction. Really,
I know, exactly. It's just incredible, you know.
But again, it's chutzpah, you know. So, yep. Okay, Joe.
All right, Tim. Well, thanks for the discussion. We'll get them next week, brother.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.